Meaning Michael P. from San Diego.
My name is Michael. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for having me here tonight. It's a really privilege. Thanks to Damien for inviting me. Thanks to the sponsees that are here tonight to cheer me on. And congratulations to the birthday folks, especially Bill. It's really been great to share the journey with you over the years. When I first moved to town here, I didn't really know anybody. I was on my way to a movie. We were talking about this during the break, and Bill and his wife at the time saw me alone and invited me to come over and said, you know, why don't you just sit with us and sit and watch the movie with us? And it's funny, it's those little small kindnesses that I've always remembered over the years from the folks that I've known in Alcoholics Anonymous is what keeps me coming back. So I just try to remember that. Welcome to the newcomers. I'm really excited to be here tonight. And if you're not really excited to be here tonight, I understand. I hope that someday you'll feel that way about this place, the way I feel about this place. I was told when I first got here, and I felt pretty miserable, that don't worry, you'd never have to feel that way again. And, you know, you're right. You didn't lie about that. I didn't have to ever feel as bad as I did when I first got here. I feel like my only job tonight is to tell you how grateful I am that Alcoholics Anonymous is here, that it was here when I needed it, and that it'll be here when you need it. And hopefully, if you can tell that I mean what I say, that it'll give you some hope that if it worked for a guy like me, maybe it'll work for you too. And maybe that'll help us all stay sober for one more day. So, you know, it's really a blessing to be asked to share this. Because sometimes I take my sobriety for granted. And when I start thinking back over the things that have happened since the day when I got sober, it's really amazing to me. It is a miracle. And I can't sometimes believe that I'm really here. There's been so many good things happen that there isn't nearly enough time tonight to tell you even, you know, one-tenth of it. But I'll do my best to try to do that. Thanks to my wife for being here. Thanks to all the other faces that I recognize. And thanks for all your support, every single person in this room, for being here tonight, helping me stay sober. You know, I came from a household that loved to drink. As far as I know, I'm the only alcoholic. I don't want to talk about my ancestry, but I will tell you that St. Patrick's Day was one of the most important days of the year, ranked right up there with Christmas and New Year's. And I always hoped that I could drink the way my father drank. He came home from work after a full day's work and would put away a tumbler of vodka on the rocks. He called it a martini, but it was a vodka on the rocks. And he'd have one or two of those before dinner and then put away a six-pack after dinner and do that pretty much every night. And on the weekends, it was okay to start around noon because if you were working on projects and the projects were half over at noon, then you could, you know, open the beer. He worked for a brewery, which was convenient, right up until the day that he didn't, and then went through a series of other occupational searches to find out, you know, what he was going to do at that time. And I always longed to be that way, too. And there came a time, you know, when I was old enough to be able to get my hands on it, not old enough to legally buy it, but I would work all day and then become convinced that, you know, it was Miller time. Or Budweiser time, or whatever else you had, you know, that I would, because I worked all day and I deserved that, right? Later on, when I got married, and you know, I felt like my job was to keep everybody else happy until a certain period of time in the evening, and then it was your time to leave me alone and let me have my time, and that was my strategy, and it worked for as long as it did. I really want to talk a lot about the solution tonight, and not so much about the problem, but I do need to qualify myself, so. You know, I can tell you that I drank my way through one marriage in my 20s and another marriage in my 30s, and I finally wound up here at age 37. But during that time, you know, the people I was married to helped me manage my life better than I could, but they did argue with me a lot about my drinking, and so I found out that if they started marking the bottles, the best thing to do was to keep another bottle out in the car, out in the trunk. And so if you were like me, you had a vodka bottle out in the trunk and you had a couple of spares in other places so that if they looked too carefully, you could, you know, wait till they went to sleep and then start filling them all back up. And so those were some of the strategies that I did. I remembered always wanting to do good, nice things, and I volunteered one time for a deal. I worked at the newspaper in Orlando for a while, and they put together a group to volunteer with Junior Achievement. And one of the things that we're going to do is work with high schoolers and try to help them, you know, develop a product and learn how business was. And so my best effort at that was to, after work, from work until 7 o'clock when the meeting started, was to get as loaded as I could. And I thought nobody could tell because nobody said anything. And the truth is I could barely talk. And the last thing I needed to be doing was driving teenagers around in a car, you know, so they could sell things door to door. But that was my job. And I have to remember that, and that's why I talk about it, because when we talk about being of service, the way it is today in Alcoholics Anonymous, like, that was my best effort at being of service to anybody besides me, you know, was to get loaded and put everybody's life at risk. Towards the end of my drinking career, my wife got on my case about maybe you should have just stop, and I said, well, maybe you're right. You know, it's a good time to stop. And so that was the last beer I was going to have. I went in the kitchen to throw it away in the trash can under the sink, which conveniently is where the vodka bottle was located. And since it was the last drink of the night, I thought, why not have one good last hit, you know? And so I tilted the bottle up and took one big long chug, and that's when she walked in and turned the lights on and caught me. And I said, I know how this looks, but it's not what you think. I'm not here, you're not there, this is not vodka. And I don't know if you've ever had that feeling, but if I could have teleported myself somewhere else, I would have, and that was not in my agenda at the time. But, you know, that's how it was. That was my best effort at being honest today. And, you know, it says in our book that there are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. I'm so glad they said the capacity to be honest. It didn't mean I had to be honest. You know, I just had to be able to eventually get honest. I was at a meeting on Wednesday, and the topic was gratitude, and I was at a meeting this morning, and the topic was service. And I've been thinking a lot about that, you know, about how grateful I am. And what I heard was that if I'm really grateful, I will give it back and I'll pass it on, and that I'll be willing to be of service, whatever that may look like. And, you know, when I finally, it's so appropriate that it's November, because it's kind of gratitude's month, and November for me was when my life finally started to fall apart. It was the beginning of the end. I didn't get sober until February 6, 1990. But I started to fall apart November of 1989, because that's when she told me she was done, and I moved out. And we got through the holidays pretending like everything was going to be the same. And then once the holidays were over, the locks were changed, and the phone calls were not returned. And I had a whole month to sit there and think about what I wanted to do next. And I'd only been to one or two AA meetings. And I should also mention, part of my story is that during that second marriage, I lived in Florida at the time, and they have hurricanes there. I don't know if you heard. But there was a hurricane that came real close around Labor Day weekend. And so the entire Labor Day weekend I got to spend with my in-laws with the worst hangover of my life. And in order to stay in the family, it was necessary for me to promise that I wasn't going to drink anymore. And for 3.5 years, I did not drink. I won't say I didn't do anything, but I didn't drink. And life did get somewhat better. But the truth is I was still very angry because other people were drinking and it felt unfair that I couldn't do it. But I wanted to save that marriage, so I did my best to not drink, and for 3.5 years I didn't. And then one day she was out of town, and I thought, you know, it's been 3.5 years. Now, I didn't go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about AA. I didn't know about the disease of alcoholism that Kat was talking about. And so one day when she was out of town, I thought it would be a good day for a test, and like the book talks about, and so I had one beer. And that's all I had. And the next day I had one beer. And I would just stop on the way home at the gas station and get a beer. And, you know, if you're only going to have one beer, you might as well get a tall boy, right? Because it's a matter of economics. And the same argument, you know, when she came home from out of town, I said, guess what? No problem. Problem solved. She didn't look like she believed me. And I continued to stay on that track of only one beer until I eventually realized that it was a lot cheaper to just get a six-pack and just have one beer. And then she fell asleep, and I had another beer, and then I didn't have enough, and so I had to go back and, you know, buy some more, and it got complicated. What I know is within a matter of weeks, I was back where I was before I quit, and worse, because the beer quit working, and only the vodka would help, and then I had to drink so much that I'd go over the line and you know, not remember what happened before. So 3.5 years of not drinking didn't do anything for me except convince me once again that it was everybody else that had the problem and not me. And so when I was sitting alone in that apartment trying to figure out what I was going to do next, I still had a job, but I'd lost a family. I'd lost 2 stepsons. I'd lost my emotional sobriety for sure. I'd lost my reason for purpose. I could see that the second marriage was going to go down the tubes, and the truth is I didn't want to lose anything else. And so out of desperation, I went to AA because she had started going to Al-Anon, and it seemed to help her. And somebody said, well, if she goes to Al-Anon, maybe if you go to AA, she'll take you back. And so I was powerless over alcohol, and my wife had become unmanageable, so I thought I would go to AA and see if that would help. And, you know, I did what you guys said to do because I was desperate, and I had nothing else going on. And what you said is, you know, go to 90 meetings in 90 days and don't drink between meetings. And because I didn't know where to go, I would ask you, well, where are you going tomorrow? So it was February 6, 1990. I walked into the Shore Acres Gratitude Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Shore Acres, Florida, which is near St. Petersburg. And it was funny because I'd been past that church before, and it was just like tonight, you know, driving up and seeing a full parking lot, and I thought, shoot, I'm going to have to go in the church service and ask them, where's the AA meeting? And I was so embarrassed. And of course, it was the AA meeting. It was just like this. And I sat down next to a guy who, it happened to be a 12 and 12 book study meeting, and of course, I didn't have a book because it was my first night there, and he shared his book with me. And that guy's name was Bill, and I'll never forget it. You know, that he shared his book with me because I didn't have a book. It was one of the kindest things anybody had done for me for a long time. So I said, well, where do you go on Tuesday nights, Bill? And he told me about a different meeting, and I went there. And then, you know, I'd get through work, and then I'd sit on my hands from 5 o'clock until 7 o'clock, and then I'd get to the meeting. And then after the meeting, they'd go out for coffee, and I'd follow them around until it was 10 o'clock, and I was too tired to do anything else except go home, go to bed. And, you know, I did that for a while. I knew I had a problem. I knew that you guys had a solution because you told me you did. And so I kept coming back. I didn't know about the rest of the steps yet, but there was something going on there, and I knew I wanted what you had, so I was willing to listen. What I remember is that I didn't know it at the time, but within a week or two, things had started to happen. There was a miracle. I went to a meeting. My wife and I were talking about this tonight. I went to a meeting. And there was a guy there that I met who was at a halfway house, and he walked to the meeting. And I said, well, what other meetings do you go to? And he says, well, I only go to this one. He had raised his hand as a newcomer. And I said, well, I heard you had to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. You can't just go to one meeting. That's not going to work. He said, well, he had been discharged from the service. He suffered from wet brain. He was a chronic alcoholic. He says, I can't get a driver's license. I can't get to any other meetings. And I said, well, I still have a license. I still have a car. I could give you a ride to some meetings. He said, well, that'd be great. His name is Richard. And so I started picking him up and taking him to these meetings, you know, that you guys were telling me about. And, you know, it was only a matter of weeks later, I was starting to feel pretty good. I wasn't sure I needed to go to so many meetings. I thought it was time to start cutting back a little bit. I got home from work and laid on the bed and thought, oh, shoot, you know, I don't want Richard to get drunk. I didn't want that on my conscience, you know, so I better go pick him up. I told him I was going to do it, and so I kept taking Richard to meetings. And so, you know, I kept going. Eventually, in fact, I had to get Richard out of a bar one time because he walked to a bar just like he walked to the meeting. And so he wasn't there ready to go to the meeting when I thought he was going to go. But you know what? I stayed sober. Richard didn't stay sober, but I stayed sober. And so the topic today was on service at at my home group. And, you know, I just thought, service might be having a commitment at a meeting like this, but you know what? It might be just giving somebody a ride. You know, it doesn't have to be complicated. If you've only been sober a week and you still have a car and you got a ride, you can get somebody else a ride. And you know what? That counts. It totally counts. And it helped me stay sober, that's for sure. When we got to the second step and it was time to talk about coming to believe there was a power greater than me that could restore me to sanity, I was really fortunate. I went to a lot of meetings on insanity, because I wasn't sure I understood what insanity really looked like. And I heard a guy at a meeting talk about one time getting pulled over and being sent to jail for 5 years for having a loose rearview mirror on his car. And he said, now that may sound crazy, he said, but the truth is, if that mirror hadn't been loose, I would have seen the cop car coming up behind me. I wouldn't have been going 85. He wouldn't have pulled me over. I wouldn't have had to try to grab his gun. I wouldn't have gone to... He says, you know, you guys are laughing. He said, but as soon as I got out of prison, I went and fixed that goddamn mirror. And I thought, I know how that goes. I think just like that. Absolutely. I don't have a drinking problem. I have an automotive problem. I have a mirror problem. I have legal problems. And so that made a lot of sense, you know. But the problem is I came from a church that I didn't trust anymore. And I don't know if you've had this experience, but you get to be a certain age. And for me, I thought, you know, God was just like the tooth fairy or Santa Claus or one of these stories they tell you to keep you in line. And when you get old enough to know better, you know it's really a dog-eat-dog world. There is no such thing. And so I threw it all out with the bathwater and did what you guys did, which was, you know, everybody for himself, I thought. And I got to this meeting and I got down to the third step. And I thought, I'm going to have a problem with that second and third step. And I went up to one of the old timers in a meeting that I admired. You know, he used to say, it's real simple. You're either going to get sobered up or locked up or covered up. Those are your three choices. And I said, well, he seems to know what he's talking about. So I'll go up and talk to him. And I said, you know, Bill, I'm a little challenged in this area. I'm not sure I can come to terms with this. And I went on with a whole bunch of stuff. And he stopped me eventually. You know, he said, well, I don't know all that much about theology, Michael. But what I figured out is, you know, I've been on this earth a few years, and my heart always seems to beat at all the right moments, and I'm not in charge of that. And he said, I seem to breathe in and out at all the right moments, and I don't have to be in charge of that either. There's a power greater than me that's in charge of both of those things. He said, in fact, if I cut myself shaving this morning, that cut would eventually heal, and I wouldn't have to be in charge of that. There's a power greater than me that does those things for me. He says, now, I'm not totally blameless in this deal. My responsibility is to keep the dirt out of the wound. You know, if I keep putting dirt in the wound, the wound will never heal. He says, so I do have a job to do. But the rest of that is all done for me, and all I have to do is give my permission. And he said, my higher power is no farther away than my beating heart and my breathing chest. And he says, I feel like a power that can heal those wounds can heal any wounds I may have. Emotional, mental, you name it. I just have to give my permission and keep the dirt out of the wound. And I'll tell you what, I've been around a few 24 hours. I've never heard it put that simply. And, you know, the truth is I couldn't argue with anything that he said. It made too much sense. And so I was willing to turn my will and life over to Bill's higher power at that time, you know what I mean, and just leave the church part out of it. And as he said, all the theology in the world doesn't matter. You know, it's like, have my wounds been healed? Do I still breathe in and out at all the right moments? And the truth was, I did. And then when I was sober a little bit longer, I heard a story that also really touched me. There was a guy that I knew where I got sober. He was a retired fireman. He came from the Boston area. And his name was Fireman Nam. And Fireman Nam used to talk about what it was like when he first got sober, and he was still a fireman, and he was in the, you know, the house. And the way the firemen are is like, you're on for 3 days and you're off for two. And so when you're on, you know, you're there all the time. And when he first got sober, he didn't want to be around all the other firemen and kneel down and say prayers. And his sponsor would get on him about this and say, have you figured out how to say a prayer yet? And he'd say, no, I haven't. And he says, well, sooner or later, you're going to drink. And he said, why? And he says, because you're a fireman. You know, and firemen face life-threatening situations all the time. And without a higher power, your time is coming. It's only a matter of time. Well, he went as long as he could, and the story was, you know, that one night there was like a three-alarm fire, and he had some real close calls, and somehow he managed to get out of it and got back to the fire station, but he was literally shaking. And as they were getting ready to turn the lights out, he said he knew that he was kind of at a fork in the road, and he didn't want anybody to laugh or make fun of him, but he also didn't want to drink. And so he screwed up his courage at one point, and just closed his eyes and kneeled down next to his cot before he went to bed. And he kneeled down and just thanked God for helping him, you know, get out of that jam. And he said, I stayed down there for a good long time until it got real quiet. I figured everybody else is already in bed. So, you know, if anybody laughs, I'm going to jump up and crack them. But nobody did. And he said, it got real quiet. And he said, I finally figured the coast is clear. And so I got ready to jump in my cot, and I looked up, and all the other firemen were kneeling next to their cots, too. And he said, at that moment, I realized it wasn't about me. You know, and he said, I learned a great lesson in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that when I do what I am supposed to do, the next dedicated thing, I give everybody else permission to do what they're supposed to do, too. And God will use me as he needs fit, you know, to show me what's the next dedicated thing to do. Well, you know, I heard that story at a really important part in my sobriety because I wasn't so sure, you know, that I was willing to do what you guys wanted me to do. And I thought, if Fireman Norm can do it, maybe I can do it, too. I just have to tell you a little sideline. I told that story at my home group, which is Mount Soledad Men's, about 10 or 12 years ago. And this young guy came up, and he said, I really love that story. And I said, well, thank you, Warren. And he said, Fireman Norm is my father's sponsor in Clearwater, Florida. And Warren just celebrated 12 years of sobriety today. And he is also a fireman. He works for Cal Fire, and he's just finished 3 years. He told us today about working for free in Mexico as a fireman just so he could get qualified. Because when he got to Alcoholics Anonymous, he had a felony conviction, and there was nobody going to hire him anyway. And all he wanted to do was be a fireman. And today, after 12 years of sobriety, he's not only been married for 6 years, but he loves his job. And every time we see each other, we think about that story, you know, about Fireman Norm, and his dad is still sober, and Norm's still sober, and Warren's still sober, and guess what? I'm still sober. And I think that's really how it works. The thing I have to tell you about, you know, that happened, sometimes I feel like everything I needed to know in Alcoholics Anonymous happened that first year. So those of you who are in your first year, I just say pay attention, you know. They weren't all good things. A lot of the stuff that I was using quit working, and a lot of it all fell apart because, you know, the things that got me here were not the things that were going to keep me here. But the truth of it is that the marriage I was hoping to get back didn't come back. It went away. She told me around in April that she'd already picked out somebody else and was moving on with her life with that guy. In May, I was 90 days sober. I got sober February 6th. May 10th, my dad passed away. Pretty suddenly, unexpectedly. And so one of the things that happened when June came around is it was Father's Day, and by this time I'd gotten a sponsor, and I told him about, you know, watch what happens on Father's Day. I've got these two stepsons, but I'll bet you I don't get any cards. And he goes, well, maybe you will, maybe you won't. But that Saturday, you know, the day before Father's Day, I ran down to the mailbox and opened it up, and sure enough, it was empty, just like I knew it would be. So I ran back up to the apartment and called her and told her how selfish she was for about an hour and or so until one of us hung up on the other one, and I'd called my sponsor, and I said, Art, you won't believe what happened, you know, blah, 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 blah. And he let me go on and on, and then finally when I was done, he said, well, I just have two questions for you. First one is, why do you always call me second? And I tried to, said, no, that was a rhetorical question. The real question is this one. He says, now, this is important, so pay attention. And he said, you've been going to this well for a while, and it's still dry. And did it ever occur to you? He said, I know you feel bad. You know, it's Father's Day. Your father passed away. You're not with your stepsons. You feel bad. But instead of calling her, what you might have done is you might have, like, gone down to an Alano club and found some guys there who are newly sober, and maybe a guy who was without his son, or maybe a son who's without his father, or maybe just some guy who hadn't had anything to eat yet today, and you might have said, hey, you want to go get a burger? How do you think you might have felt if you'd done that? And I said, well, probably better. And he said, yeah, you probably would. And he said, but this is really important, so let me just repeat this so you'll never forget this. He said, the next time you feel bad, instead of finding people who have what you need and try to take it away from them, you can find people who need what you have and give it away freely. And you will feel better immediately. And you will never need anybody's permission to do that. And I'll tell you what, the reason I always tell that story is because I don't want to ever forget that. You know, that's like, to me, the big, big secret here, you know, that when I feel bad, I can do something for you, and I don't need your permission for it, and I'll feel better immediately. Now, as he said to me, you know, I said, that makes perfect sense, Art. He says, well, that's 180 degrees away from the way you've been doing it so far, so good luck, you know, turning that around, because that's not my first inclination by a long shot. You know, it really isn't. But right off the bat, you know, like, those were some of the early secrets that he told me. In the early days, you know, things got worse before it got better. I was living in a pretty cheap apartment. I used to do my laundry at the laundromat. I had things to do over the weekend. I came back one time, and two loads of laundry was gone, was stolen. And I called Art, and I said, you'll never believe what happened. And so I told him what happened. And he said, well, evidently someone needed it more than you did. That's not what I thought I was going to hear. You know, I thought I was going to hear, you're right, that's terrible. That's not, he goes, hey, let me ask you, can you get more clothes? And I said, well, yeah, but that's not the point. He goes, yeah, well, maybe the guy that took yours couldn't, you know. You can get more clothes, he won't. So let's move on, you know. And I'm very grateful he gave me so much good advice, you know, back in the day. He wanted to go ahead. I think we had this discussion where I said, you know, Art, I think it's time for me to do my fourth and fifth step. And he goes, okay, well, let's get going on that. And I said, but I'm not sure I'm ready. He said, well, then let's not do that. And I said, but it seems like everybody else is doing it. And he said, well, then let's do it. And I said, Art, I don't know what you're telling me. Should I do it or not do it? And he goes, yes. Do it or don't do it. But don't just sit there thinking about it and talking about it, because that won't do you any good. And you know, actually, he repeated that a lot. You know, if I got into trouble, he'd say, you know, have you prayed yet? And I said, well, I've thought about it. He said, only an alcoholic gets confused between thinking about something and actually doing it. He goes, does thinking about eating make you less hungry? I said, not really. And he goes, there you go. So, you know, being restored to sanity is not an easy process. Right around October, I lost my job, and it was the first time that I'd ever been out of work and not married to somebody who wasn't working and could bring in money. And I really was deathly afraid of that I was going to be homeless, and I couldn't figure out what was going to happen. And the funny thing is, I had been telling Art I really wanted to do my fourth and fifth step, but my work was getting in the way. And so when I lost my job, he said, well, that problem has been removed, hasn't it? And I was just so afraid that I actually did finally start to sit down and do it. And I went through and did a fourth step and a fifth step. And all I can say is that, you know, I was expecting from looking at the book and listening to people like it was going to be some incredible drug rush or something. And what was so surprising was when they said to go home and just, you know, be quiet, what I noticed was that there was a weight that had been lifted. And I was just fortunate enough that I was asked to speak at a meeting a lot like this that night. In fact, that's why we did the fifth step when we did, because he said, before you tell them, why don't you tell me? And so we had our fifth step, and then I went home and was quiet for a couple hours, and then I came and told my story at a meeting like this. And what I noticed after the meeting, when everybody came up to say thank you, was that the wall between me and you was suddenly gone. And I didn't know it was there until it was gone. You know, the suit of armor I had been wearing all those years because of all my secrets was taken away and was removed. And suddenly I felt like I was part of, and you and I were the same. And that was the real beauty of doing a fourth and fifth step for me. And so if you haven't done a fourth and fifth step yet, that's my best effort to get you to go forward and do it. You know, is that life gets a lot easier when you're not hauling all that weight around, at least it did for me, and feeling so separate. We finally did that fourth and fifth step. Before I knew it, it was the holiday time again, and because the holidays are coming up, I really want to make sure I do this. You know, the beautiful thing around Thanksgiving and Christmas and all these days that are so special for us, especially when you're newly sober, you may not have family handy, which I didn't either, is that it's hard to know what to do, I think, because everybody else seems to be having such a wonderful time, and here we are, if you're newly sober, you know, kind of hanging on for dear life. And for me, you know, I went back to St. Louis, which is where I grew up, and it was the first Christmas without my father. And my family likes to drink a lot, in case I didn't mention that. And what happened is we had Christmas on Christmas Eve over at my mother's house, and everything was over by 10:30. Those that drank as much as they could were gone, and the rest of them had gone to bed. And I came all this way to IC St. Louis to have Christmas, and it was 10:30 on Christmas Eve, and I hadn't had Christmas. And somebody had told me about a meeting that was going to be going on that evening at Central Office in St. Louis, North County Central Office, at midnight, for anybody that didn't have anywhere else to go. And I was just desperate enough at that point, thinking, you know, I came all this way. And so I got in the car, and I drove over to Central Office, and I thought, well, I don't know who's going to be here, but there was about 12 people. And the way they did the meeting for Christmas Eve on that particular night, I don't know if they still do it, is they started off with the person leading the meeting had a candle, and when they read, then they passed it to somebody else, and they lit their candle, and then the next person that shared lit their candle. And when everybody had gone around the table, you know, it was like daylight because all these candles were lit. And the amazing thing was, as I recall, there's a Marine there who had just gotten back from Iraq. This was the first war, 1990. And he told a story about having come through some countries where he was not welcome as a Marine, as a U.S. Marine, but he was welcome as an alcoholic. He talked about meetings in the foxholes where these guys that couldn't drink, you know, were digging foxholes and then having meetings in foxholes. And that amazed me. And then there was a guy there who said that his sponsor of 7 years had just passed away 2 days earlier. And he broke down and started crying. And, you know, we went all the way around the room, and I talked about my dad and coming, you know, all this way and how the family didn't really have Christmas yet, but thank you for being here for me. And the thing is, we all walked out, you know, a lot lighter. And I remember being out in the parking lot and hugging all those people. And the guy said, well, do you feel like you had Christmas? And you know what? I did. I finally did. So he said, that's the best part. You know, he said, alcoholics, we don't have to wait for Christmas to have Christmas. We give each other gifts every single day. We just don't wrap them up. And, you know, my sponsor used to say that all the time, too. Whenever I came to something I was supposed to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, he'd say, well, you can do it or not do it. It's just like the present under the Christmas tree. You know, it just waits for you until you're ready to do it. When you're ready to open the gift, you'll open it. So I was at this meeting on Wednesday night talking about gratitude, and that's really what came through, was the guy said, you know, the word gratitude comes from the same word as grace, which means it's a gift. He said, the hard thing is to look at some of the harder things that we have to do as if they're gifts. My buddy Art, God bless him, said to me, I had a commitment at a meeting at my home group. I was supposed to hurry up and get home, get off of work and go start the air conditioner. This was Florida because it was hot. So we got the air conditioner going and started the coffee. And I was I was running late, and I had like 26 lights to go through before I got to the meeting. And I they were all green lights. And I said, Art, you won't believe it. You know, I hit nothing but green lights. It must be God's will. And he said, well, Michael, he said, someday you'll be grateful for the red lights too. And it didn't make any sense at the time, you know. It makes a little more sense now. When I was 5 years sober, I got a chance to move here to San Diego. So I've been here since 1995. I really didn't know a soul when I got here, but I went to this meeting at Claremont Men's, and I put my hand out and started introducing myself. And immediately I had 40 new friends. I took a year off because I really wanted to get to know you guys a little bit better. My new sponsor that I found when I got here got on my case a little bit about why I wasn't dating, and I said I took the year off. And when the year was up, he said, you know what, it's time to get back on the horse. And I said, I don't think so. I think life is just fine the way it is. He goes, what are you afraid of? I said, what am I afraid of? Rejection? You name it. And what he said was, we're going to learn how to do this because sobriety is about walking through fears. And if you're afraid of something, you know, let's figure out how to do this. So I swear to God, this is the truth. He instructed me on how to date. Because I said, I don't know how to date. I take hostages. You know, if they like me, that's good enough. You're not leaving. And he said, yeah, that doesn't work. That's why you keep getting what you got. So his idea was, you know, what do you like to do? Like to go to the ball game? Get two tickets. Go up to somebody at a meeting that you like and say, you know, I got two tickets. Would you like to go? I'm going. Would you like to go with me? If they say yes, you go. If they say no, you ask somebody else. And then you go. And then you don't call them back. You're just trying to figure out what you like. You know, you don't pick out the china. You don't plan a wedding date. You just move on. And you do this for 6 months. And, you know, believe it or not, I did. you know. And I remember calling that man, Dave Moore, and asking him if I was ready to pick out a sport coat. Would he come look at it? Because I never spent $150 on anything in my life. I didn't trust my own judgment. He said, sure. He came over and helped me. You know, that looks great. You should get that. You should definitely get that. After about 6 months of that, I found this woman that I really, really liked a lot. And we went out a second time. And then we went out a third time. And she said, you have to leave right away? And I said, I do. I'm dating around. I've got this program. And she said, that's too bad. I was hoping you could hang around. And I said, you know, let me make a phone call. And I called my sponsor. He said, I think you're ready to move to the next level. And next December, we'll be married 16 years. I know we really need to wrap it up. There's a lot more I'd love to tell you about it. But, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is the best thing that ever happened to me. I didn't know how good it could get. I had no idea, as other people have shared here tonight. It's really hard to be willing to let go of what you got in order to have something better. For years, I was motivated by the stick. When it got bad enough and it hurt bad enough, I would quit doing what I did and try to do something different. What you guys have taught me is to be more motivated by the carrot. You know, I was told that coming in here for an alcoholic is like, you know, we come into the world with this grand mansion and something bad happens, and instead of figuring out what it was, we just lock the door. And so, you know, there's lots of other rooms. I won't go in that one. And before you know it, you're living in the hallway. And the guys come up and say, how come you're living in the hallway? And the worst part is you say, what hallway? You know, because I don't even get that. You know, I don't even realize how small my world has gotten. And what you've done for me in Alcoholics Anonymous is say, let's go back in those rooms one room at a time, and I think you're going to find out there's nothing frightening in there. And some of those rooms I've walked into with you guys, and what I've found is a banquet and a fire in the fireplace and everything just waiting for me. And I wasn't going to go in that room, you know. This sobriety thing is a game of inches and seconds. And what I know today is one more drink or one less drink, and I might have missed the whole thing. And I'm so glad I did, and I'm so glad you're here. God bless you. Thank you.